Welcome back. I'm Kara Miller, and you're listening to The Emily Rooney Show. Today, we take a look at the many faces of marijuana as a dangerous gateway drug, as a pain-easing medication, and as a potential multi-billion dollar boon for the economy. How much do we spend to stop pot use in the U.S.? Does it make sense to legalize it for everyone? And what is its real medical potential? Are we approaching a tipping point where marijuana follows alcohol and gambling from criminal offense to pastime and a huge new source of taxes? A little later, we'll be joined by Kevin McKiernan, CEO of Medical Genomics, a Marblehead firm that has just finished sequencing the cannabis genome in an effort to attack diseases like cancer. And we will also hear from Dr. Jody Gilman, a research fellow at Massachusetts General Hospital's Division of Psychiatric Neuroscience, where she studies the neuroscience of drug abuse. But first, I spoke a little earlier to Jeffrey Myron, a senior lecturer in economics at Harvard University and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, about what the legalization of drugs could mean, both financially and socially. Jeffrey Myron, senior lecturer in economics at Harvard and senior fellow at the Cato Institute, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
When you look at actually the prohibition of alcohol in the 20s, would you say that there are similarities between the way marijuana and other drugs are prohibited now and that experiment in the 20s that obviously was repealed fairly quickly?
Oh, it's very much the same experiment, and we got basically the same results. The policies were similar, and the results were similar. Perhaps some reduction in the amount of use of the substance that was prohibited, but not very much. And at the same time, a bunch of negative consequences in the form of increased crime, corruption.
How much does it cost the government, the U.S. government, every year to prosecute drug crimes, and in particular, if you know, marijuana?
So for marijuana, the total expenditure by all levels of government for prosecution, arrest, incarceration for marijuana is about $17 billion a year.
Okay. And, you know, you have argued that having drug prohibition, probably much like having alcohol prohibition, is a terrible idea for taxpayers. Tell me your rationale for that.
Well, there's first the reasons why it's a bad deal for taxpayers. There's the 17 or so billion that we're spending, okay, and there's also probably about 17 billion that we're not collecting in tax revenue. Excuse me, did I say 17? That 17 was the total. It should be 8 billion in expenditure and 8 billion in tax revenue. That's not a huge amount compared to the overall size of the U.S. economy or the overall U.S. budget. But what's even more important is what are we getting for that expenditure or that loss in tax revenue? We're harming people who want to use marijuana peacefully, responsibly, without harming others. Hey, we're generating more crime and corruption by driving the market underground, making it harder for people who have legitimate medical needs for marijuana to be able to use marijuana as medicine. So we're spending money and losing tax revenue, and we're creating bad consequences, not good consequences.
Wouldn't, though, more people be inclined to try drugs if they were legal? If you could just pick them up along with a pack of gum, wouldn't you have a whole bunch of people who currently wouldn't go into the black market to get them, but if they were easy to get, they might give them a shot?
The evidence suggests that there are probably a few people, like you described, they would be affected by whether marijuana were legal or not, but it seems that the vast majority of people are not much affected. They try it or not, depending on their own taste, their own curiosity. Basically, everybody who's teenage years says that they know where to get marijuana if they want to in various surveys. Now, it's clear that a huge fraction of the population has tried or had easy opportunity to try it, even though we have all the prohibition. So we're not doing very much to discourage use. And a large amount of any use that might occur, even if we didn't have prohibition, wouldn't be hurting anybody. So we shouldn't care about that, just as we don't care about people consuming alcohol as long as they're doing it responsibly. We only try to punish the use of alcohol that leads to negative consequences for other people, such as driving under the influence.
I'm wondering what you think of the sort of new pot entrepreneurship, I think we could call it, in the 16 states that currently have medical marijuana laws. As we've seen the ranks of those states grow, what has been your opinion of how marijuana use has expanded there?
There's very little evidence that we've seen any increase because of those changes. Basically, as we were discussing, the people who want to use marijuana use it. The people who don't, don't. It's like many people don't use alcohol. Many people don't smoke cigarettes. In fact, there's a huge decline in the number of people who use tobacco over the last 50 years, even though it's still a perfectly legal product.
Yeah, but we have seen in some medical marijuana shops in places like Colorado and California, we've seen marijuana-laced peppermint cups and cookies and brownies. Isn't there some attempt, you know, when it's legal, to make it a friendlier substance to people who might not, want to, let's say, smoke marijuana?
There absolutely is. And that, again, may have some effect on how many people consume it. But first, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Okay, we should be very honest that there's nothing wrong with using marijuana for the vast majority of people who use it. For some people, it's an enormously beneficial thing because it helps deal with the medical issues. But even for people for whom it's purely recreational, if they're not harming anybody else, why should society care? That's exactly the attitude society takes toward tons of risky activities, from bungee jumping to downhill skiing to alcohol and tobacco. If you're not harming someone else, it's your choice whether to take any particular risks. And most of what's going on is that we're just seeing people who want to consume marijuana now can consume it in a nicer fashion, but the number of people consuming and the amount they're consuming is not changing very much. The evidence does suggest that there's very little effect on the degree to which people use because of the introduction of medical marijuana or anything like that.
What do you see as the impact, let's say marijuana was legalized for medical use and for other uses, what do you see as the impact being on places where marijuana is grown? We've obviously seen a lot of drug crime, not all of it, of course, attached to marijuana, but in places like Mexico. How do other countries factor in here into the drug picture if we were to legalize drugs?
Well, I think they actually factor in less and less and less. Okay, so marijuana can be grown in every state in the union. It can be grown in more or less every country, and it is grown in a huge fraction of those places. So there's less and less coming in from Mexico. The violence that we see in Mexico now is actually not so much related to the marijuana trade. It's much more related to the cocaine and methamphetamine trades. So there are cases where I think people are overpromising about what would result from legalization. I think it's actually not so far wrong to say that de facto we've gone a long way toward already legalizing marijuana because, especially in places with liberal medical marijuana laws like California, anybody who wants marijuana for whatever purpose only has to jump through very, very, very minor hoops in order to get access to it legally from a medical marijuana dispensary. So we will see some reduction in crime. We'll see certainly be able to collect the tax revenue, but changing the situation in Mexico, that's not going to happen because of legalization, because we're too close to legalization. Too much of it's in the U.S. already.
We're obviously talking about medical marijuana and some of the practical uses of it today. But I'm wondering if politically you see these laws that allow the use of marijuana for medical reasons, which, as you said, there's some relatively small hoops to jump through to get that marijuana. Do you see that politically as being an entree into just the plain legalization of pot with no caveats that you need to use it because you're sick for some reason?
It might turn out that way, that this is sort of a partial step and we'll eventually take the next step. But in California, we had a bit of an experiment along those lines where California voted in November of 2010 on full legalization, even though they already had a very sort of liberal medical marijuana framework, and they voted against it by a moderately sizable margin. So it's not obvious. It seems like there are a lot of people who like the fiction that somehow it's being controlled because it's medical, not just, like a stick of gum at the grocery store. So I can imagine that we'll end up with this sort of in-between system that everybody kind of knows is de facto, basically, legalization. The crucial thing is what the federal government does. Okay, states can move, as California and a few others have done, very, very close to legalization without officially going there. When they said they were considering going officially all the way, the federal government said, not so fast. If you do that, we, the federal government, are going to come and impose our anti-marijuana laws on you, California.
Right.
Californians were nervous about that, and I think that's part of the reason they voted the legalization down.
Well, do you see a split between the federal government and the states? I mean, obviously, the federal government for a long time has sort of hewed to this cry of a war on drugs. Do you see them moving away from that at all or not particularly?
I think it can sort of go back and forth. The people thought the Obama administration would be much more sympathetic to moving toward legalization. Initially, it seemed to be because it announced that it was not going to enforce federal laws in places like California if people were consuming for medical purposes consistent with the state laws. But then just recently it changed its tune and said that local U.S. attorneys could enforce the laws as vigorously as they wanted. They clearly were trying to discourage the legalization initiative in California. And this is from an administration that's basically liberal democratic. If we get a Tea Party administration or something, the pendulum could swing way farther back toward the just say no years of Reagan or Bush. So I don't know. The federal government has an awful lot at stake. The bureaucracy that enforces prohibition is going to fight tooth and nail to prevent any fundamental change.
Is there an argument that, from your perspective, advocating the legalization of drugs, is there an argument that works the best when you're talking to the public about whether or not to legalize drugs, and in particular, marijuana?
Well, I guess I think the argument that will work the best over the longer haul is the one that says, why should the government be telling people what they can or cannot put in their bodies unless that is causing harm to others? I think the arguments about the budgetary benefits actually don't persuade that many people because, one, the budgetary benefits are very small, and two, everybody sort of knows that all the advocates of legalization would be advocating for legalization even if there were no budgetary benefits. That's just sort of icing on the cake. That's gravy. But the fundamental issue is freedom, is letting people alone as long as they're not hurting anyone else. And I think that resonates with a pretty large fraction of the population. So getting people to think about the parallels between marijuana prohibition and alcohol prohibition and other risky things that are legal but and that are sometimes dangerous but not always dangerous, I think that's the most effective argument.
Jeffrey Myron, Senior Lecturer in Economics at Harvard and Senior Fellow at the Cato Institute, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And joining us now is Dr. Jody Gilman, a research fellow at Mass General Hospital's Division of Psychiatric Neuroscience, where she studies drug abuse and its effect on the brain. Jody Gilman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So my first question to you is, let me pick up on something Jeffrey Myron said. He said there's nothing wrong with using marijuana. Do you find that to be true in your study?
Well, what we do see is that chronic and heavy use of marijuana is absolutely associated with memory deficits and difficulties on some attentional tasks. What we don't know is whether such changes are permanent. It's hard to say whether these deficits in attention and memory last after the person has stopped using. There are some studies that indicate that these deficits can last from 24 hours to about a month after use, but there haven't really been studies looking at longer term than that.
And, you know, I know you've also studied alcohol and its effects on the brain, and you've looked at marijuana. Can you compare a little bit what it's like looking at a brain where somebody's had a lot of alcohol versus marijuana?
Sure, sure. Well, alcohol is extremely neurotoxic. And when you look at people who have used alcohol for years and years, very, very heavy alcohol drinkers, you see a lot of structural abnormalities in the brain. You see enlarged ventricles. You see reductions in cortical thickness. You don't really see that with marijuana, to my knowledge. Part of the issue is, though, that these studies haven't really been done of chronic marijuana use. But you don't see the same kinds of deficits with marijuana that you see with alcohol.
So if, let's say you weren't talking about people who had abused alcohol, but you were just talking about casual drinkers and casual users of marijuana, people who do not abuse the substance, do not use it all the time. How would you compare the effect in that case?
On the brain, you mean?
Yes.
So the issue with that question is that when you do research studies looking at alcohol or looking at marijuana, what you usually do is you recruit patients who do abuse the substance or who are heavily dependent. I'm not sure if there have been very many studies done on just the casual user who doesn't necessarily reach dependence.
One thing, of course, that comes up very often when people talk about whether or not to legalize marijuana is the argument that it's not addictive, unlike, of course, drugs like heroin and cocaine. Can you talk a little bit about whether you find that to be true, that marijuana is indeed not addictive?
That used to be the prevailing knowledge, but more recent research has indicated that it is absolutely addictive. Marijuana, just like other addictive drugs, stimulates brain reward areas. And when these brain reward circuits are stimulated, people experience a sense of euphoria or high, and they like it, and they want to continue using. So marijuana, just like alcohol or cocaine, can be associated with a loss of control over usage, a preoccupation with usage. And actually, research from the National Institute of Drug Abuse suggests that about 9 to 10% of casual marijuana users do become addicted to marijuana. You can experience withdrawal symptoms when you quit marijuana, including irritability, sleeplessness, decreased appetite, anxiety. So yes, I would say it was addictive.
So, you know, when you compare that level of addictiveness, you mentioned two other things, alcohol and cocaine. Is mm-hmm. there any way to compare the level of addictiveness of marijuana with, obviously, cocaine is not legal and alcohol is? Mm-hmm. Any way to look at those three substances together?
I'm not sure if studies have directly compared. I'm sure epidemiological studies have looked at prevalence. I think that, again, this would be a biased study because alcohol is legal and it is easier to get than a drug like cocaine, especially. So we do see high rates of alcoholism.
Another question for you is, do you find when you do these sorts of studies and people mm-hmm. come in who are heavy marijuana users, mm-hmm. is it a common gateway drug?
Right.
And they get into other harder drugs through
right.
marijuana?
Right. That is a very interesting question. Studies have shown very strong associations between marijuana use and initiation of other illegal drugs. But this is an association, and it's unclear as to whether there's actually a causal link. And there have actually been papers published recently that have used modeling to show that there may be other common factors, such as propensity for drug use, or people who score high on risk-taking scales or sensation-seeking scales, that increases the likelihood that someone will use marijuana and increases the likelihood that they would initiate use of other drugs. So it's very hard to say that use of marijuana causes somebody to go out and use other illegal drugs.
And does it matter at all when you start in terms of its effect on you, both its effect on the choices you make later, potentially in terms of taking other drugs, but also in terms of what it does to your brain, whether you're a 13-year-old, using pot, or you're a 25-year-old?
Right. So, interestingly, people who are in treatment for marijuana abuse tend to have begun at an earlier age. I believe the National Institute of Drug Abuse's statistics say that almost half of the people in treatment for marijuana have started using by age 14. Whether or not that's because these kids had other problems before they started using marijuana, such as comorbidity of depression or anxiety, is not known. But there's a pretty strong association between the age of use and the likelihood of becoming addictive. As far as its effects on the developing brain, adolescence is a critical period of brain development. And any drug that you introduce at that time, whether it be alcohol or nicotine or marijuana, will have an effect on the developing brain that would probably be more pronounced than on the adult brain.
And finally, I know you're going to try to do some extensive research on the effect of marijuana on the brain. Tell me what your research is hoping to discover.
I'm actually hoping to look at decision-making in a college-age population, whereas studies have shown that people start using alcohol and tobacco a little bit earlier in middle school or high school. Studies have shown that marijuana use often begins in college. So I'm interested in pinpointing that group of people who have just started to use marijuana, and I'm looking at their decision-making capability in the brain.
And is that like right after they have taken the marijuana, or even, a week later or a day later or whatever?
Oh, so I actually am not necessarily looking at acute effects. So I'm doing functional magnetic resonance imaging studies. So they're not actually high at the time they come in, but they have used in the past week.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Jody Gilman, Research Fellow at Mass General Hospital's Division of Psychiatric Neuroscience. Thanks for being here. And now I'd like to explore the therapeutic effects of marijuana, including potential anti-cancer properties. My next guest has just finished sequencing the cannabis genome in an effort to find the parts of the plant that are medically valuable. And here's the buzz-killing twist: make them into drugs that don't get people stoned. Kevin McKernan, CEO of Marblehead-based Medicinal Genomics, joins me now. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kevin McKernan, you were one of the lead researchers on the Human Genome Project. I'm wondering how you landed on marijuana as something that might have these anti-cancer properties.
It's a great question. So as the sequencing technologies got better and better, we quickly started applying them to sequencing patients' tumors. And then I became involved in networks of oncologists that were sequencing people's DNA and their tumor to try and find drugs that would specifically kill the tumor. And that's when a lot of my friends started asking me about cancer. And a few had pointed a few papers to me that that were related to some of these compounds in the plant that were shrinking tumors. Now, granted, it was preliminary. It was in rats and in cell culture. It hasn't really been put to work to people. But cancer is such a big problem in the country that we spend $228 billion a year fighting cancer. So it's something that if anything shows promise, you have to part the Red Sea and just go after it. And so that's what kind of tuned me onto it.
So tell me about this process of starting up medicinal genomics just a few months ago.
So it was challenging because despite Massachusetts saying that underneath 28 grams of marijuana is considered decriminalized, it's still not federally decriminalized, just as Jeffrey was mentioning. So I consulted a few attorneys and they said, you know, your best bet if you really want to do this is just to go to the Netherlands and get the DNA there. And then once you have sequence information, you can move that anywhere in the world and that's legal. And so that's what we did. We just went about that course. We selected a few strains that looked as if they had some history in medicinal use and started focusing on that problem.
Could Massachusetts change its laws so you could have done that initial research here and not in the Netherlands?
No, that would have to be required by the DEA and from the federal government. And we are in contact with them to try and get those appropriate licenses over time, but they do take time. And the research space doesn't really afford you to wait.
And I just wonder, do you think that's a mistake? Do you think that our laws are so strict that people are forced to, as you did, go out of the country? And I wonder if anybody goes out of the country and just stays, just takes their lab outside the country.
Several have done that. I think the critical point of this discussion is that we begin to separate medicinal legalization from recreational. Because the recreational one is a much larger and more complicated social problem, as Jeffrey's laid out. And if we can separate the medicinal part of it, we won't be slowing that process down with the rest of the larger social problems. And it's very important for the patients. I mean, patients that are in pain or have cancer or dealing with these things, they don't want to wait until everybody gets comfortable with full-blown legalization. That could take a very long time. It's proven to take decades.
We know that, you know, currently cancer patients in many states, 16 right now, can get medical marijuana to alleviate their pain to some degree. Now, that's not what you're talking about in terms of isolating cancer-fighting properties, but I wonder, is there a relationship?
There is a relationship, and some of the challenges that the patients are finding is that every plant is, in fact, very different. It's a very diverse species. It actually looks as if it's three different species kind of interbred. And as a result, the levels of the compounds, these things called cannabinoids inside the plant, vary drastically plant to plant. So they may have it working really well for 1 week and then switch to a different strain and things change a little bit. So we're hoping to bring a little bit more regulation and measurement around that so that we can find strains and get them to be consistent and understand what makes a strain deliver a certain type of cannabinoid profile.
Has it been hard for you to get drug companies on board? Are they reluctant because there's a sort of marijuana illegal drug association with this research?
Well, there is. They're much more likely to want to find an individual compound and pull it out of the plant and put that through the FDA. And I think that's been done once or twice already with a drug called Marinol. They're now recognizing that the other compounds in the plant are necessary as well. And they're one by one pulling those out and making these cocktails. And I think where the trend is going to go is they're going to recognize that, you know, the plant extract is probably the best bet. It's going to be very difficult to make hundreds of different compounds and turn that into a pill and mimic Mother Nature. In the end, it'll probably be just cheaper to grow it.
And when you get that plant extract, are you able to take out the compound that makes people high?
You can, and the pharmacology on this would actually advise you not to do that completely. In fact, the pharmacology implies that a little bit of THC combined with CBD is this other non-psychoactive cannabinoid, gives you the best response. And in fact, the CBD attenuates the psychoactive effects of THC. So the best thing is actually a mix. And there's a company called GW Pharmaceuticals that's actually taken that path. And they're doing two different plant extracts together that have a mixture of these two things. And that's a drug called Sativex. So complete elimination is probably not the perfect pharmaceutical solution, but it is probably the most palatable one inside the United States.
So tell me what you're seeing in your research in terms of how effective potentially compounds or parts of the marijuana plant or the whole thing is in being effective on dealing with tumors.
So we have not done any work actually applying this to tumors. Right now, all of that is based on a paper that was published out in 2003 from Manuel Guzman. It's a nice review paper that shows 9 different tumor types, including glioblastoma and breast cancer, being affected by this. We're at a very early stage where we have just sequenced the first 2 genomes of the plant just as to build a foundation for the field so that we have sort of a roadmap for measurement that as people want to work in this field, they can actually utilize that sequence as sort of a starting point. With that sequence, we'll probably be partnering with people to try to help them breed plants that make a better profile for a particular therapeutic. Or they'll use this information to track different plants or to fingerprint them so they can understand which strains are legal and which ones aren't legal if we ever get into a legalization scenario.
So when you look 5-10 years out, when do you think that something you're doing right now in Marblehead could be tested on actual patients?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. It really depends on the political circumstance. But currently today, there are people that are not necessarily in clinical trials, but are experimenting with medical marijuana for various instances. So in theory, we could be sequencing these genomes and just understanding exactly what is that genome and what plant did that produce and know that if that's the plant that you're prescribing for somebody to be using, if it's ever changed in the future. Because we actually had a snapshot of it at a given time. So it's a little bit more of a process manufacturing trick today. I bet 5 years out, we will see many cannabinoid compounds coming through the FDA that have gone through the typical, you know, distill it down into a pill and give it out as a drug type of approach.
Is the benefit from the marijuana plant, is it available by smoking it? Or would this be something where the compounds are, there's so much of it that's needed that you really need it distilled into a pill?
No, there's various routes of administration, and that's actually a very important question because most people assume that you just have to smoke this, and the smoking comes with certain probably negative side effects to the lungs. Folks can vaporize this. They can put this into brownies, as our last caller mentioned, and they can also put this into a spray, which is a sublingual spray, like a mouth spray, which is what Sativex is doing, and that actually goes right into right through your your skin and your tongue and absorbed in your body. Each route of administration has a different sort of dose response curve. If you're smoking it, it goes out of your system in an hour or two. If you're going through an oral administration, it has to go through your liver, and so that gives you more of a 6-hour type of dosage. So for different symptoms, different routes of administration are going to be required.
There's been a little talk that making the DNA sequence of the marijuana genome available to people allows other people to take it wherever they will, and they could, you know, create a tougher, hardier, and a strain of marijuana essentially that would get people more high, that would be more potent.
That's possible. I think we're a little bit late to that party, though. People have been doing that for 30 years, and the plants today are already up in like the 25% range of THC. I can't imagine them getting much higher than that without the plants just falling apart. But it's possible. But with it comes also, I think, an incredible ability to measure and a degree of precision on this that we've never had before, is that we can now actually selectively breed these things for the right therapeutics and as opposed to simply supplying a recreational demand. And that's what's been missing, I think, in the last 30 years.
I wonder, when you're starting a new company and you're out there and you're looking for venture capital, is this tough to say, well, my company is based on marijuana? How have you found that when you sort of go out there and look for funding?
Oh, it's the first response is career suicide and the door shut. I mean, it's a challenge every day. But the more and more you teach people about this space, they come to recognize that this is just like any other compound. It's in fact naturally grown. It grows very quickly. And there's actually a complete void of science in the space. I mean, there's a lot of work done on addiction. There's a National Institute of Addiction, of Drug Addiction. There isn't a National Institute of Drug Benefits.
Is that because people are scared of talking about the benefits associated with
just,
drugs?
It's just that the charter for NIDA is to look for the damaging effects. They will not fund a project that looks for the benefits. And so I would be – I'm very excited about actually Dr. Gilman's work because she's going to go into colleges. I think if you did a survey, instead of going into the addiction centers, if you go to a survey in the hallways of MIT and Harvard and ask how many people have used this once and many times, you'll get a lot of hands that go up. And many of these people become our presidents. So this is that's a needed study, which is what does happen in the general population? Let's stop just looking at the tails of the distribution. Let's look at the entire population and where it can have some benefit.
So have you been able to convert people and actually get funding for this kind of research?
I have. Once they recognize that there is a legitimate way to go about doing this and that it's actually pharmaceutically driven and that there's a very wide and changing market, a lot of people are strong proponents of it.
Kevin McKernan, CEO of Marblehead-based Medicinal Genomics, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That is going to do it for us this afternoon. Thank you to all of my guests throughout the hour. We will be back tomorrow at noon with a conversation about the murky ethics of gender selection from China and India to right here in New England. And stay with us now for the Callie Crossley Show coming up next. The Emily Rooney Show is a production of WGBH Radio, Boston's NPR station for news and culture. On the web at wgbh.org/EmilyRooney. I'm Kara Miller. Have a great afternoon.